Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly. Coming up on today's episode, the future king is in his counting house, counting out his money. Does Prince Charles need to tidy up his finances to stop ending up on the front of the Sunday Times? We'll take a look at the Prince of Wales, his finances, the donors who get too close to him, and what all this means for the future of the monarchy with Gabriel Pogrand and Roy Nicker from the Sunday Times. Before that, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. Normally it's Libby Rachel, but no Rachel Sylvester today. So today we've got Libby Purvis and Patrick Kidd. Good to have you both here. I suppose we should start with the story that everyone's talking about in Westminster. Story on the front of the Times today. Tory rebels saying Boris Johnson's handling of claims the Conservative whip drunkenly groped two men has bolstered their efforts to oust him. I mean, you also wonder how many bolsterings of efforts to oust him there need to be before he's actually ousted. Or is this just wishful thinking on the part of rebels, do you think, Libby?
Well, I have defaced this programme before with my very stupid former prediction that Boris himself would jump for freedom months ago. Freedom, big bucks on the lecture circuit. He'd say, I led my land through a pandemic and then I succumbed and now I need a private life. And I was completely wrong. He is holding on like a limpet. I really can hardly understand it as a fellow human being, and unless he's just enjoying the international stuff so much. But I'm afraid the parliamentary Tory party is going to have to grow a pair and take action, because his unpopularity across the country is really quite staggering now. It's getting to sort of beyond Thatcher levels, if you remember what it was like, you know, when the entire country was behaving like a child trying to escape a domineering mother under Mrs. Thatcher, as she then was. But I think his unpopularity is now even greater, and they're not going to win another election with him. And, you know, it's coming up in a year or so.
Yeah, it's interesting, Patrick, the disconnect between Conservative MPs and even Number 10, who insist that Boris Johnson's a great election. I mean, you know, if we separate for a moment what we might think, just if you, through pure cynical self-interest and self-preservation, if you were a Conservative MP right now, looking at Boris Johnson's polling, you know, 60% say he should stand down, 65% say he's incompetent, 74% say he's untrustworthy, 55% say he's weak, 56% say he's dislikable, 63% say he's indecisive, 69% say he's doing the job of Prime Minister badly. And yet, they sort of convince them that this idea is the Heineken politician who can reach parts of the country that others can't. I mean, it's true. He's managed to convince whole swathes of traditionally Tory areas that he's not up to it.
Yes, well, I thought one of the more silly claims in deputy PMQs last week was Dominic Raab telling Angela Rayner that the big difference between us is we're united behind our leader and you want to get rid of yours. I thought, there's not... I've detected a huge anti-Keir. They may think Keir Starmer's a bit dull, but I don't think they're actively trying to get rid of him, as 148 Tory MPs did. But, I mean, there are some who would think that Boris Johnson has to lose in an election that he has to be rejected by the electorate. Otherwise, even if he goes, he will then just say, oh, it's the ghastly media and it's traitors in my party that got rid of me. And I think that's also why there's not been a direct move against him by the would-be future prime ministers, because they think actually it's now, it's got to the point where even a change of leader isn't going to swing the election. So let's let him wear it, if you like. They'd probably be quite keen on an early election to get it out of the way. But, you know, the greased piglet, as it's been called, wriggles through. I'm inclined to agree with Libby. I think at some point he'll go just because he wants the money to pay for however many children he has by then. I wonder how many more sex scandals are to come, because it seems every week seems to bring a new one.
Do you think, Libby, there are often parallels drawn with the 1990s, that actually... We are now. I mean, the single biggest thing that was going to stop the Tories winning in 2024 would have been the fact they've been in power in one form or another for 14 years. I mean, that fact alone is quite a hurdle to overcome. Do you think that there's just a sense of inevitability now that somebody thinks something must be done, but not yet, and probably by someone other than me? And that just means that actually Boris Johnson will survive. He will lead them into the next election. And actually, based on current polling, we'll probably end up with a totally indecisive mess of a result.
I think that could certainly happen. But what fascinates me about the parliamentary party is there must be a sense in some of them, and I mean, there's some of them expressed it, a sense of shame, a sense that this is not the party we wanted to belong to. This is not the party that we joined. This is not what we believed in. Because there are, I mean, you know, I'm sorry to apologise to any serious Guardian readers listening, but, you know, there are good conservatives. You know, there are people who have strong principles. And I think the embarrassment of what's going on now, you know, not just the actual misdeeds, but the evasions, you know, from the parties and the sleaze and everything else. It must really hurt. And I do feel for people. I wish that more of them would just sort of say, look, actually enough, you know, and choose a new leader who has at least a better record and who believes in the things that they do. But I don't see enough sign of that, really.
Patrick, I remember it was our colleague Hugo Rifkin had this very good line at the height of the Brexit rows. The problem with Brexit was that for the Tory party, it was so off-brand, sort of blowing everything up in the hope of something exciting happening. It was the opposite of sort of conservatives, conserving things, leaving things alone, you know, incremental change here and there. And actually, everything that's happened really under Boris Johnson has been off-brand, you know, whether it's the sleaze stuff, the money stuff, breaking the rules, the you know, not being entirely truthful about things. All of that is just, it's just not very conservative, is it?
No, and I mean, traditionally they have won success by being competent and just being trusted to get on with generally trying to make people's lives better. And I think there's no indication of that going to happen. They talk sort of aspirationally about levelling up and things like that, but there's no policy, there's no energy. And this happens with governments after a long period in office, of course, and it happened in the 90s. And John Major was a different sort of prime minister to Boris Johnson, but nonetheless, a tired government ran out of ideas until, you know, the Cohn's hotline became the totemic policy. We haven't even got a Cohn's hotline. and so they need a spell in the wilderness to revive and to get ideas and try and work out why they want to be in government beyond just being in government, beyond preservation.
But this is absurd, isn't it, really? Why should they get tired? I mean, yes, I agree. I remember that desperate weariness, you know, when we all sort of flung our arms around Tony Blair with little squeaks of relief. But you know, there is no reason a party should be able to refresh itself and have people and ideas coming up from the bottom. And you know, I don't know why this has to happen. Is it complacency? Is it just being an MP for so long that you forget that you're not invincible?
It's a good question to which I don't totally know the answer. But actually, the most striking thing is actually the total lack of ideas. From, you know, you're right, Patrick. There's no Cohn's hotline. This morning they're announcing something on childcare, where the minister Will Quince has been going around saying it's not going to make a huge difference. He was trying to make a virtue of not doing anything very big. You know, baby steps. He said, excusing the pun, for talking about childcare. But you know, this is now 14 years of the government. They can't really do it, even despite having a massive majority. Anyway, let's move on. Because I want to talk about this. Let's talk about the Isle of Wight. It's a great story in the Times today. They've been looking at the Office of National Statistics figures from the census, and the population in the Isle of Wight, aged 65 and over, rose by 25% between 2011 and 2021. Is rising by bigger than anywhere else. The numbers aged 20 to 24 fell by 13%, and it's sort of partly because it's on an island, I suppose, it's sort of even more pronounced. But there will come a point where presumably there won't be anyone left on the Isle of Wight, Libby.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a good joke, the whole business of the ageing of the Isle of Wight. And I think if you could pick on a lot of rural areas where the same kind of thing happens, I mean, North Norfolk, for instance, if you knock out the second homers and so on, is like that. But I would just like to point out that just over the water at Leon Solent, there is my young nephew and his young wife, both advanced go-getting young people. So it's not far away to find the young. But I do get quite upset. I speak as one of the guilty oldies. I rejoice in a proper mix in every part of the country. You know, when there are young children living down our lane, which there are, I'm absolutely delighted. And I wish the birth rate wasn't declining. And I wish that we weren't using up so many family-sized houses when there are just two people in them, and levelling up matters. And the whole Dick Whittington thing, have you got to go to London to get anywhere, that's gone too far as well. I think there is a huge problem of ageing Britain, and the sort of the Isle of Wight joke, as it were, is quite a nice little thing to point us in that direction.
But Patrick, this is levelling up in action, isn't it? Or not in action, as it may be, that if you young and you grow up in somewhere like the Isle of Wight, and we a couple of weeks ago, we were talking to several of the Channel Islands, and they've all got this problem. The young people leave for the mainland, house prices are going up, they're all being driven up by wealthy pensioners.
Well, that's not levelling up, that's levelling down.
Exactly,
I mean,
right,
Patrick.
Well, it's also a sign of a place becoming desirable. So pensioners want to move to the Isle of Wight because it's a nice lifestyle, they get the beaches, the climate, nice pubs and stuff like that. And because they do that, bringing in their wealth, that means the price of the properties go up. So therefore, the young people have to leave because they can't afford the properties. And there is a cycle there. And obviously, building more homes is one answer. But, you know, I grew up on an island. Libby probably knows it well with her sailing connections, Mersey Island near Colchester. And it's lovely to go back. But as my cousin, who also grew up on the island and moved to London, says to me, it's sometimes good to go back to remind you why you don't want to live there.
Well, you see, look at you. You're a Dick Whittington.
I never knew you grew up. I don't know why I would have known, but I didn't know that about you, Patrick.
But my parents and my mother's father emigrated from East London to Mersey. They wanted a better lifestyle as they were getting into middle age, and sometimes it just replenishes. It happens. You go to the city, then you come back again when you want a different lifestyle.
And there's two people from the Isle of Wight are doing their best to try and make the Isle of Wight cool again.
Is your muffin buttered? Would you like us to assign someone to butter your muffin? Excuse me.
Now, I assume that both of you are familiar with the work of Wet Leg.
I need to.
They're very good.
I associate the Isle of Wight. I associate the Isle of Wight with music. It used to have a famous rock festival.
Yeah. Well, it still does.
And I'd love to have a parallel universe where Jimi Hendrix has sort of settled in cows and set up a tea room or something.
maybe that's the start of it. It's just into a sort of permanent year-long music festival, Libby.
Yes, I suppose so. What part of the problem with some of these areas where a lot of retired people settle down is that they then don't like the noise and racket of the young turning up.
And then they complain.
And that is something that, I mean, we have Latitude just across the field from us, and I hear the bang, bang, bang noises in the night, the strange, weird bang, bang, bangs. And I sort of, I welcome it, you know, and if other people complain, I say, no, we should be pleased, you know.
Yeah.
Even if they're only here for a weekend, at least there's some young blood around.
Well, that's a good point, because at least, you know, they're around and they're spending money and, you know, everyone was young once and all that. Just finally, Libby, your column today, Suppose it's a good question. What happens when we take down all the statues? Latvia are taking down lots of Soviet-era statues. But your point is that actually the statues are... at the risk of reopening this old argument, there's a good reason for keeping some statues.
Yes, I got completely riveted by the pictures of some of the ones they're getting rid of in Latvia, especially the enormous head of Lenin, who looks like a granite version of Max Headroom. And apparently the locals didn't want it destroyed, and they put it in a forest some years ago when the USSR collapsed. But I think it is interesting to look around at the statues we have and at the resentment they sometimes cause. You know, it sort of flashes up like as the Colston thing did, and say that actually, you know, the Prime Minister was for once right. Perhaps we should say this once a day, when he said, look, we've got a complex historical legacy all around us which reflects all of our history, and you can't just retrospectively change it. You know, so sometimes you have to sort of say, look at that old swine up there, you know. Oh, you know, I'm glad he's not here now, and remember it. So, but I also, the other thing I wanted to think about was how nice it is that in the age of mass media, we're suddenly getting some fantastic statues of people that the public actually loved in a way they probably didn't, the sort of Duke of Wellington or Charles II.
Yeah.
You know, that we're getting pictures of, where we're getting Amy Winehouse and Eric Morecambe.
Eric Morecambe's a good one.
Victoria Wood and so on. You know, actually entertainer statues. And I love that, the fact that that's sort of springing up. And of course, there are other sort of heroes suddenly appearing. Oliver Tambo is a lovely statue of Oliver Tambo. Right down in the park in Haringey. I think it's statues evolve and life moves on, but you don't want to throw away all the old ones. So it was in praise of statues more than anything else.
Who would you like to see a statue of, Patrick?
Well, I'm just reminded of what Boris Johnson said years ago when asked why he wanted to be Prime Minister, and he said because they don't put up statues to journalists. I'm not sure whether there'll be a statue to Boris Johnson.
There's one to Reuter.
We look forward to Taunton having a statue of you, Matt, one day.
I do mention, though, that there's a wonderful statue of Reuter, you know, the father of news coverage, with wonderful granite side whiskers, was made by my friend Michael Black. So some journalism does get it, little bits of statue.
And George Orwell, isn't there an Orwell statue outside the BBC? If I imagine that?
I think there is.
Well, I'm not sure the BBC's still going anymore, but anyway, for the time being. There is. I've just looked it up. There is a statue of George Orwell. You know, I mean, he counts as many things, but we'll claim him as a journalist as well. Libby Purvis and Patrick Kidd, then. Of course, you can read them in the Times every week. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox to get yourself a subscription. Up next, we take a look at Prince Charles's finances.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
The future king is in his counting house, counting all his money. But where does it come from? What do donors expect in return? And just how big a suitcase do you need to hold £1 million in cash? We take a look at Prince Charles's finances this morning. The oldest heir to the throne for almost 300 years and increasingly taking on some of the big duties from the Queen, including just recently attending the state opening of Parliament.
My lords and members of the House of Commons, Her Majesty's government's priority is to grow and strengthen the economy and help ease the cost of living for families. Her
Majesty's but with all this increased responsibility comes increased scrutiny of how he operates, including the way money passes through his office and charities. Well, Gabriel Pogrod is the Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times, who's been investigating all of this. And Prince Charles's finances keep ending up on the front page as a result. Morning, Gabriel. Thanks for joining us. Where to start, really? What was the trigger of your particular interest in Prince Charles and his finances?
You know what? It all came about by accident, as many of the best stories do. Henry Zeffman and I were looking into the Tory party chairman, Ben Elliott. And readers may recall last year that we did a story revealing that a Tory donor had paid Ben Elliott's company, his concierge business, quintessentially, and off the back of that, booked to go on a private jet up to Charles's beloved estate in Scotland, Dumfries House, and have dinner with the future king. And off the back of this, we got a load of tips from people saying this sort of syndicate where the world's wealthy people can pay fixers or intermediaries and get in a room with HRH. I mean, you haven't even got a fraction of how big and institutionalised this all is. And we ended up, spending a lot of time basically poring over hundreds of documents that showed that Charles's closest confidant, the notorious Michael Fawcett, and a load of fixers had secured an honour for this Saudi billionaire. That's now under police investigation, but that was basically our way in. And since then, we've been marinating in the world of royal sleaze, and it makes politics look clean, to be frank.
And so let's work through some of them first of all. So the Saudi tycoon Khalid bin Mahfouz gave £1.5 million to a charity associated with Prince Charles, and then subsequently got CBE. That's now being investigated by the police. Then there was your revelation a week ago about this £1 million in a suitcase from Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim, former Prime Minister of Qatar. That's being in the charity that was a total of £3 million in all between 2011 and 2015. They're now saying, oh, that was all in the past, a long time ago.
Half a decade ago, no less.
A whole half a decade ago. Yeah. And they definitely wouldn't take money in suitcases now.
If it was a year ago, they'd have said it was a tenth of a decade ago.
And now just yesterday, another revelation, this time involving Lord Brownlow, who listeners will remember, was the guy who offered to pay for the gold wallpaper in Number 10. More recently, was being lined up to stump up £150,000 to build a treehouse for Boris Johnson at Chequers. Not for Boris Johnson, for his son. Although, you never know.
Key distinction.
You can't rule it out. Explain what's going on with this story. How's Lord Brownlow now moved from politics into the Prince Charles story?
I mean, he's a fascinating man, Lord Brownlow, but he basically has this decade-long pattern of conduct of bailing out extremely powerful and influential but occasionally cash-strapped people. You mentioned the Boris, his relationship with Boris. He also was the white knight that rescued David Cameron's wife Samantha's fashion company when it was hemorrhaging £500,000 a year. He took a 10% stake in that. And then we revealed yesterday he'd also been bailing out Prince Charles. I mean, one of the sort of interesting structural factors over here that people probably wouldn't assume is Charles doesn't have that much money. It was actually in 2007 that he took out a £20 million loan in order to buy Dumfries House. It was going to be bought by an American buyer. Charles said to his friend, the Marquis of Bute, I'll put together some money. Let me save it for the nation. Since then, it's been the sort of headquarters of his philanthropic empire and his weekend estate. But he basically struggled to pay the debt back ever since. He actually told an ITV documentary in 2012 that the debt kept him up at night. I don't think most people assume the future king spends his nights, in cold sweats thinking about the debt. But Brownlow is one of a number of people alongside the Saudi and HBJ, the former Qatari PM, who he's turned to in order to bail out his actually quite financially troubling situation.
Let's just focus on Dumfries House for a moment. I think we've got a clip. This is Prince Charles speaking to the BBC's Hidden Heritage in 2011 about why he wanted to take on that task of restoring Dumfries House.
But I'd heard about this house, you see, that there was difficulty with it and that they wanted to sell it and find a solution. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. And I remember trying 4 years before it actually came up for sale as a problem. I tried to find a way of seeing if we could help sort it out or find somebody who might help a sponsor, a donor, whatever, but it was just such an enormous task.
An enormous task, which has sort of got him into trouble. I suppose, is the starting point with this, is that Prince Charles wants to do good things. His heart's in the right place, maybe. You know, there's this house, it needed restoring. You know, or we'll come on in a minute and talk about the Knockroon development as well. But he starts off with, like, this is a good thing to do. But like you said, he doesn't have any of his own money, so he ends up getting into bed with people that, probably when it's on the front of a national newspaper, it looks like it would be better if he hadn't done that.
That's a great analysis. I think another thing as well is that it's not only that he wants to do good things and has good intentions when it comes to those good things. He doesn't respect the constitutional convention whereby even if he happens to have opinions, he doesn't act on them. I think this is probably the problem at the heart of it. For three decades, Charles has been lobbying and advocating for causes close to his heart. Some of them perfectly laudable, like restoring a dilapidated, beautiful 18th century Palladian manor. Others probably a little less laudable, like lobbying for homeopathic treatments to be made available on the NHS. But in a way, it kind of does a disservice to the debate to focus only on the weird and wacky things that he lobbies for. I mean, I do think his Foundation for Integrated Health is probably the most notorious, but he's also lobbied against modern architecture, which he happens to dislike. But even if it's great stuff, it's the fact that he feels this entitlement to lobby and advocate on behalf of his causes. That's why he set up all these charities. I mean, it's not a normal thing. The Queen doesn't have, you know, charities through which tens of millions pass and go on to causes close to her
heart. What she does is she's the patron of existing charities, and which sort of bestows support upon them, but she's not involved in the fundraising and the day-to-day running of them.
Exactly. It's funny, like, in the newsroom, we often reflect on the word charity, but the moment you introduce that word into a piece of journalism, people think, oh, well, it must be good then. I mean, a charity is just a legal structure that allows people to do things in the world, to pursue objectives that the charity deems to be charitable. But the question is it right for Charles to be intervening in the world in this way?
And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Is that by pursuing good things, you know, he likes the environment, he likes, you know, building houses for communities and all that. Well, who could object to that? The point is that actually if you're observing the constitutional rule or the constitutional norm that you don't have an opinion on anything, then being for or against nice houses is not something that he should necessarily be sticking his oar into.
Yeah, I mean, during the We only know this because of the Guardian's years-long legal case, but, I mean, he lobbied new Labour ministers on everything from army helicopters to the Patagonian toothfish. I mean, he basically just has lots of big opinions,
yeah,
and he acts on them. And nowhere is his opinion about how the world ought to be more visible than in Dumfries. This is basically his Charles HQ. I mean, Clarence House is his London base, but in terms of where he goes to be at peace with the world, where he feels like his values are exhibited to visitors and to all those who pass through. I mean, Dumfries House is the place. So you're right to identify that this is kind of the blank canvas on which Charles has attempted to make an indelible impact.
And actually, the fact that it's in Scotland is a long way from Westminster and, you know, the prying eyes of the media. I mean, a lot of this stuff probably goes a bit under the radar. So let's go back to the story that you had then yesterday, Gable. Lord Brownlow spent £1.7 million bailing out Prince Charles' failed eco-village in Knockroon in Scotland. This is Professor Alan Dunlop. He's a leading Scottish architect who criticised the plan at the time. He spoke to Times Radio earlier about why he thought the scheme failed.
His heart was probably in the right place. I was first asked about Knockroon in 2010 and the creation of Scotland's Poundbury and whether I thought it would stack up. An analysis of Poundbury in Dorchester, which has a population of mostly professional classes, some 75,000 people, in comparison to Auchinleck and Cumnock, former mining villages whose industries, textile and engineering industries, have gone, has a population of 16,000. So from that point of view, I couldn't quite see how the thing could stack up right from the very start. I'm not necessarily talking about the architecture of it and the design and the overall look of it, but just from a purely development point of view, I couldn't understand how you could possibly make it work.
So that was Alan Dunlop speaking about Knockroom. Well, maybe one person who can try and stop that happening is Tobin Andre, currently deputy editor of the Daily Mail. He's about to take over as the new communications secretary for the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall, as revealed by Roy Anika, the royal editor of the Sunday Times, just yesterday. Well, I caught up with Roy a little bit earlier on to discuss Prince Charles and all of his problems and how focused he might be on taking on more responsibility from the Queen.
Well, I think we've been seeing that for the last few years. I mean, you know, the Prince of Wales and his household with the Duchess of Cornwall, you know, first and foremost, his main public role is to support the monarch. And given that what we've seen over the last few years, you know, the Queen no longer travels overseas, so he's stepped up his duties there for the very big sort of national moment sometimes now, things like at the cenotaph, the Queen no longer lays a national wreath, so Prince Charles is doing that. So yeah, the state opening of Parliament this year was opened by Charles and William. So we are seeing an ongoing trend in terms of the Prince of Wales stepping up more and more into that role of assuming a lot of her duties.
And with that increased responsibility and sort of public profile, is coming more scrutiny in terms of, you know, both what he does now, but also what's happened in the past. Do you think, I mean, nobody enjoys scrutiny particularly, but how does he feel about that, the sort of increased investigation, not least in the Sunday Times, about his finances, his foundations and charities and so on? How does he feel about that level of scrutiny?
I doubt he welcomes it, but at the same time, there's a big difference between the way the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall look at media coverage. You know, his press secretaries have always said to me he is very much focused on his public work and not on whether he's in favour or out of favour in the headlines. But that said, you know, he won't be immune to knowing that big, these revelations that have come out, that some probes by the Charity Commission now into some of the revelations will, you know, make people question more and more about the future of how his charities are run, how much of an arm's length he has from them. So he's not blind. He understands that people will be asking some serious questions, and perhaps he needs to rethink his involvement with his charities.
And I suppose when you've had, you know, Prince Harry on one hand, Prince Andrew on another, making all the big headlines, it's not like this is the biggest thing which has threatened the royal family in recent times. But as we get closer to the point of him assuming the role of monarch, I suppose there's going to be more and more focus on the way that he operates. And so do you think he sort of needs to sort of get his house in order a bit more ahead of that?
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, and I think he understands that. You know, when he turned 70 a few years ago, there was that documentary where he was asked, you know, very probing question, will you stop writing to ministers? Will you stop meddling? And he said, of course, I understand the difference between that role, my future role, and my role now. And as you say, the closer he gets to that role, you know, with an aging monarch who is now 96, the Prince of Wales really does need to, you know, when change of reign comes, he needs to be able to assume that role whiter than white, almost, with no, almost no sort of cause for criticism, because he's stepping into boots, the Queen's, one day, who really has, you know, conducted herself in an almost sort of, I don't know, she's never been through any scandals like this. Yes, there have been scandals in her reign, of course, tons of controversy, but we've never seen anything like, you know, question marks raised over her involvement with some of the charities or question marks over money. So I think he really does, yeah, you're right. He needs to try and sort out that side of his role and his life so that when he does take the top job, things are much more straightforward and there'll be less scrutiny on that front.
And how much of this, if being fair to Prince Charles, you know, a lot of this is to do with charitable works, you know, trying to do good, you know, not all of it successful, but, you know, starting out on the basic premise of, well, you know, building some houses here or helping out good causes there. And actually, in order to do that, you know, and politicians find the same thing, you end up sort of swimming with people who have got lots of money and maybe do or don't want something in return. And it's this sort of murky world of, you know, we want the royal, supporters of the royal family, want the royal family. With that, you expect sort of bells and whistles and pomp and circumstance and all of that. But that requires being paid for. And so, you know, and it's where, I suppose it's where you draw the line as to, you know, how close you get to those people who've got big checkbooks.
I think I would say two things on that. First of all, I would say absolutely the Prince of Wales is harder than the right place when it comes to, you know, charitable works. Look at what he's done with the Prince's Trust and dozens of his charities, which do amazing things. I think the other thing I would say is perhaps he needs to keep a closer eye on who is managing those charities for him and maybe reassess, does he really need to be raising all that much money? You know, Dumfries has, for example, his Palladian mansion up in Scotland, which he saved for the nation. It has, you know, the foundation has done a lot of good work around that. But did he really need to be raising millions and millions of pounds for the restoration of, you know, some bridges? Or, I think he just needs to rethink about that because, you know, you're right. He does need to be very careful about who he's associated with. He is the future king after all. And perhaps the role of his charitable work and the way in which he goes about fundraising perhaps could be slightly reassessed.
And just sort of looking forwards then, do you think that there are active moves to sort of tidy things up a bit, or has he not yet sort of got to that mental position of, you know, moving from the, you know, long, you know, he's waited for a long time heir to the throne, that actually maybe, you know, he always talks about slimming down the monarchy, actually slimming down his operations would be quite a smart thing.
Well, I think we've already seen that, you know, one of the closest people to him who was so deeply involved in the Prince's Foundation charity, Michael Fawcett, no longer works for the Prince of Wales. You know, that's a big move towards tidying things up. He's currently subject to, you know, involved in matters that the police are investigating. We saw it the weekend. There was a story saying that one of the Prince's charities is advertising for a compliance officer, which I think tells you that much more focus is now being looked at compliance of these organisations than perhaps had been before.
That was Roy Anika, the Sunday Times' royal correspondent, giving us her assessment on that. Gabriel Pogwin's still here, royal head of the Sunday Times, who's been doing a lot of the stories on this. I suppose I should ask you, but what does Clarence House say about all this, apart from, I imagine, being annoyed that you keep phoning them on a Friday afternoon and saying, oh, I've got another donor that I've got some questions about. Do they feel like they have questions to answer, that this is an issue? Are they trying to sort of clean things up a bit?
Great question. They're certainly annoyed. You mentioned, Roya mentioned a few moments ago, Michael Fawcett's resignation. I mean, there are five investigations.
We should explain, Michael Fawcett was like the closest aide to Prince Charles.
Yeah, he'd been forced to resign twice from Clarence House. He came back again and again. I mean, he was the man that could make things happen for HRH. He was the person who gave effect to Charles's will in the world. And off the back of our story last year, he quit, most presumed for the last time. A lot of one royal insider said to me he was extremely conspicuous by his absence at the Queen's recent Jubilee. People would usually go to him to get seats. He wasn't even at the event. What did Clarence House say? Their steadfast position, in particular on the honours question, and which is obviously so toxic for him because it's the literal police involved, is that he had no idea about any of it. And often the Clarence House position is, these are questions for Charles's charities, which are independent organisations run by their trustees. So their basic position is that Charles knew nothing about the honours deal. He has, and all sort of legal and fiduciary responsibility falls on the trustees. So basically, ask somebody else, but not us.
Well, let's some focus on that then. And there is now a police investigation into the suggestion of an honour being given as a result of donations. Norman Baker's a former Liberal Democrat MP and former minister. He's author of What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know. And Norman joins me now. Norman, you wrote to the police calling them to look into exactly this.
Yes, indeed, Matt, because it seemed clear to me from the letter that was published in the Sunday Times and the Mail on Sunday, there was a prima facie evidence that an offence had been committed under the 1925 Honours Act, in that an honour and indeed help with citizenship application had been offered explicitly, it seemed to me, in return for money for Prince Charles's good causes. And the Metropolitan Police then subsequently wrote back to me and said, we are now beginning a criminal investigation, and that, as far as I'm aware, is continuing. And it's relevant that you bring that up because, as has just been said by Gabriel, the response from Clarence Household, which is not me, Gov, I don't deal with these matters, Prince Charles says, it's done by some flunky somewhere, I sail above it all. Well, of course, that defence, to my mind, has been shot through by the fact that Prince Charles was caught, to use a vernacular, red-handed, receiving bags of money in form of mace and carriers from the former Qatari Prime Minister. And now we know that he's been engaged in the same direct way with Lord Brownlow, according to Sunday Times front page, in terms of money for Dumfries House. So it seems very clear that Prince Charles is intimately involved with these matters.
I'm interested, Norman, in the fact that when Lord Brownlow was involved in paying or not paying for Boris Johnson's wallpaper, Westminster was alive with calls for investigations and resignations and, you know, the Labour Party were all over it and Conservative critics of Boris Johnson were all over it. And it, you know, the story was given endless legs by interventions by politicians. This time round, Gable does extraordinary work week after week in the Sunday Times. And he's met by total silence from the Westminster establishment. And I know you're not an MP anymore, but did you feel when you were an MP under pressure not to speak out about what the royal family were up to?
Well, I mean, there should be voices in Parliament, not least of all, because the donations in question, Lord Brownlow and the Qatari Prime Minister, were not included in the court circular, and therefore a distinct attempt was made to hush them up very clearly. But look, I mean, in 18 years I was in Parliament, I think I was the only member of Parliament to initiate a debate on anything to do with the royal family, which was, I had to link it. So they make it very difficult for you. I had to link it back to the obscure Treasury paper in 1993 in order to get it past the House of Commons clerks. But the wider point is this. MPs, many of whom are Republican in nature, I might tell you, particularly in the Labour and Lib Dem groups, don't think it's a matter to be raised because they think it's either a vote loser or as a distraction, or be painted as some sort of extremist. Now, they keep their head down. They say it's more important to deal with A, B, and C. That's where they are. Actually, this is very important because this is about our constitution. This is about the future monarch in terms of Prince Charles. It's about how public money is spent. And my view has always been that those who are receiving public money, whether it's MPs, councillors, people in the health service, or anybody else, Network Rail, they should be held publicly accountable. And the public accountability for Prince Charles and the royal family is woefully inadequate, not least of all because Prince Charles lobbied the government to exclude the royal family as far as possible from the Freedom of Information Act.
You talk about how difficult it is even to mention the royal family. This was the other day, Keir Starmer mentioned the Queen at joined PMQs, and Common Speaker Lindsay Hoyle intervened.
Yes.
Sorry, Prince. We normally would not, and quite rightly, mention the royal family.
Even the very mention of the royal family is frowned on. Never mind, you know, saying, well, I'm not sure if the heir to the throne should be receiving money in carrier bags.
Well, look, I mean, at any one time, the minimum percentage of the population that's Republican is 20%. It goes up to about 45%. It ebbs and flows between those two figures. But if you take 20% of the House of Commons, that's about 120, 130 MPs. How many actually say anything at all about the royal family? Well, Chris Bryant does occasionally, and that's it, I'm afraid. And, you know, we're not representing, the MPs not representing the public properly by failing to address these issues. There are huge sums of money involved, as well as propriety issues, and the MPs ought to be really far more involved. I'll be writing shortly to Meg Hillier, the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, because there are so many issues about royal finance to be looked at. But where's the Public Accounts Committee on this? Nowhere.
Yeah. Norman Baker, it's really good to speak to you. Final word to Gable Pogrant. Where does the story go next? Do you have more of these cases to wade through, these hundreds of documents you're looking at?
We do. I don't know that you'll see anything imminent, but there is more. And I think we just need to see where this Met investigation goes. I mean, there are investigations by the Met, the charity regulator, the Scottish charity regulator. I think there are about six of them right now. So we'll have to see if they are actually going to, if these investigations will have bite or whether they'll sort of defer to the establishment as these things often turn out to be. But we'll see.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio, and we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.